Meeting will come to order. Coincidentally, we are having this hearing today on a day that I understand we are going to count to get the updated count of those who are without a home. And so it seems like a good time to start our work. I think you were part of that counting effort last year, as I recall.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I will be this afternoon as well.
This hearing, I have to give full credit to MICA. And you see on your agenda, MICA stands for Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. They came to me with this suggestion last year, and that is the cultural differences in some of the housing issues and some of the challenges and opportunities in the various refugee communities. And because we only meet once a week, last year, we just ran out of time. This was supposed to be on the agenda, but suddenly we were up against bill deadlines and had to start hearing bills. And we're going to have the same issue this year, and I didn't want to get into that same situation. So we're putting you at the head of the line before session starts so that we are certain that that we use this. So thanks so much for all of the effort that's gone into pulling this particular hearing together. And I believe we are just going to start with you. You're going to make some introductory comments. Right. We have a couple of videos, and so I'll just turn it over to you, and you can walk us through.
Madam Chair, Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and Vice President of the National Coalition for the Homeless. I had the opportunity to help start the National Coalition in the early 80s, as well as the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, as well as one of the founding board members of MICA. What we're going to show you first is about a seven-minute video. It's called Housing Now 2020. This was developed by the National Coalition for the Homeless to help people that have not been involved in housing or in helping people experiencing homelessness to understand how we've had this four decades of growing homelessness and how homelessness has been a part of our culture since the colonial days. And so we're going to show that video first, and then Gary will do some opening remarks. I will do some other opening remarks, and then we'll show you a second video that will talk about the importance of having people that are impacted by the housing and homeless crisis, especially our diverse populations, in being major decision makers and helping determine how we actually create the housing opportunities and the services and the homeless services that we do provide.
And I should just explain to members, your MICA's videographer is in the room. He's been part of putting these together and is covering today. So
Justin did the second video. The first video we did as a part of the National Coalition. Thank you, Madam Chair.
On October 7th, 1989, tens of thousands of people marched on the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. They gathered to hear Tracy Chapman talking about a revolution and Stevie Wonder call out for love and kindness. They gathered to be inspired by the words of Jesse Jackson, Susan Sarandon, Martin Sheen, Coretta Scott King, and the event's organizers from the National Coalition for the Homeless, National Low-Income Housing Coalition, the Community for Creative Nonviolence, and the National Union of the Homeless. They gathered to stand in solidarity, those who were homeless themselves, along with their housed allies. They gathered to protest the severe lack of safe, decent, and affordable housing in the United States. October 7th was a sunny autumn day, and the flags surrounding the Washington Monument flapped in the breeze as marchers who had crossed the Potomac River from the Pentagon merged with the mass of people gathered at the monument. Others walked the nearly 4 miles from RFK Stadium, where they had been sheltered in the days leading up to the march. As they converged, the marchers made their way past the AIDS quilt laid out in rows on the National Mall, down Connecticut Avenue toward the Capitol. Some estimates put the number of protesters at 150,000. They came from the streets and the shelters, from churches, union halls, and school playgrounds. They came from kitchen tables and park benches where local organizing efforts were born. They came from Miami and Portland, Denver and Los Angeles. They came by the busload from Boston and Atlanta. More than 500 people came by bus from Chicago alone, and a group of 250 people walked to Washington from New York City, a trek of 16 days. Children from Dayton, Ohio, pulled red wagons full of letters to Congress pleading for action. And people came from the streets of the nation's capital itself, where they would sleep again that night and the next and the next. Together they had one simple demand, housing now for all Americans. Specifically, they wanted restoration of $24 billion in federal funding for affordable housing that had been slashed from the nation's budget under the Reagan administration. These cuts, along with the growing income and wealth gap, were widely understood to be a major driver of the dramatic rise in homelessness in the early 1980s. Many local marches prior to October 7th built momentum that culminated in the Housing Now! March, which was and remains the largest collective outcry for housing as a basic human right in the nation's history. Building on previous advocacy victories, such as passage of the Stuart B. McKinney Homeless Assistance Act in 1987, the momentum galvanized by the Housing Now! March led to additional victories, such as creation of the Cranston-Gonzalez National Affordable Housing Act in 1990. The march also coincided with a groundswell of activism. Local grassroots organizing flourished, and acts of civil disobedience occurred across the United States, including occupation of empty buildings, a coordinated multi-city take-off-the-boards campaign during the months leading up to the Housing Now! March. Many of these efforts were led by people who were themselves homeless and by the faith community, which has played a central role in responding to the homelessness crisis. While Housing Now! Was organized in response to the epidemic of contemporary homelessness in the United States, it is important to recognize that homelessness did not begin in the 1980s. In fact, historians such as Roberta Ann Johnson, Kenneth Kuzmer, Todd DePastino, and others have documented waves of homelessness that go back to the earliest days of colonization. Over the centuries since it first appeared in the cities of the Eastern Seaboard, homelessness has impacted some more than others. Native Americans and African Americans, immigrants, veterans, people with disabilities, children and youth, and the elderly. Homelessness has spiked with each major economic recession and has receded as more humane policies have gone into effect, including veterans benefits after the Civil War, Social Security for all Americans, Medicare and Medicaid, and a massive infusion of federal funding for affordable housing in the years following World War II. This combination of housing, healthcare access, and guaranteed income caused homelessness to recede, so that when the homelessness epidemic exploded in American cities in the 1980s, it felt new. Since then, millions of Americans have experienced firsthand the horrors of living without a home. Men, women, children, youth and young adults, veterans who fought for this country only to be failed by it when they returned from war, people suffering from mental illness and addiction, people fleeing domestic violence. In cities across the U.S., people of color, particularly Native Americans and African Americans, remain disproportionately overrepresented among the ranks of those experiencing homelessness. Homelessness is not new, it is not colorblind, and it is not inevitable. Homelessness can be shaped by changes in public policy and funding priorities, which can in turn be shaped by grassroots organizing and civil disobedience. As the United States continues to face homelessness on a massive scale well into the 21st century, it is important to ask what we can learn from the past, from our successes and our failures. First, community-based grassroots organizing is an essential catalyst for social change. Those in power never cede that power without well-organized, focused outside pressure. Political will is absolutely essential to create social change and to drive resources to solve homelessness, but it will never occur without strong, unified organizing. Second, those most affected by homelessness must be in decision-making roles around funding, policy, programming, and advocacy. Finally, we need a dramatic recommitment of resources at the national level to restore affordable housing to a level that allows every American to have a roof over their head. Such a commitment requires political will and a collective commitment to move beyond our society's complacency and acceptance of homelessness as inevitable. As we seek to learn from the past and chart a better course for the days ahead, we must rethink our current approach, recommit to grassroots organizing, and elevate the voices of people experiencing homelessness. Housing Now! 2020 represents a step in that direction. Designed to re-energize local, state, and national advocacy, Housing Now! 2020 provides a platform for advocates to come together to demand a significant increase in federal funding that keeps pace with rising local need. Housing is a basic human right. Homelessness is not inevitable. We must and we can do better.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, would like to thank you for taking the time to view that. You may have seen that a number of us were from Minnesota in the 1989 march, and many of us have been involved in housing and homelessness for a number of years. I'd like to turn it over to Gary Kwong, who is the board president of MICA.
Oh, committee. And I grew up in St. Paul, and my father was a PhD chemical engineer for 3M. But I grew up in an area that was an unspoken segregated area because people would not sell to minorities in that area. So I grew across the street from Cole Park, and I went through grade school, high school, and the University of Minnesota without meeting any other Chinese except those my dad brought home from work when they came to work at 3M. So I became familiar with the refugee cultures because it was the first time I'd met people like me who could come here. And one of the differences is that when we have immigrants, one of the big issues now is immigrants versus refugees, perhaps, the understanding. Because refugees are classified by the UN, and often they spend years in refugee camps before the UN classifies them and before they're admitted to the United States. And right now in Minnesota, we have 2% of the U.S. population, but 13% of all the refugees who come to the United States. And Minnesota has the largest number in the United States of the Karen, the Tibetans, Somali, Hmong, Oromo, and Liberians. And I'm not sure about the Vietnamese and Cambodian numbers relative to other metro areas. But we have the largest populations, but because of their organization is often through their social service agencies, I've asked that the social service agencies working with those groups come and talk to you. Because most people in Minnesota who are not from those cultures don't really know very much about them. And one of the problems we have is compounding with the lack of language skills, which people will talk about, is the communication style and the fact that when you're a refugee, you don't necessarily trust government because that's why you're often here, is because your government did not treat you well. And so one of the other factors I want to talk about is their cultural group number is important. The lack of education, their communication style is different. So for many, as you will hear about, if you say, trust me, that isn't going to happen because they don't know who you are. And the development of trust between these cultural groups and the majority is often different than people think it ought to be. There's no instant trust just because you say for your you're from the state of Minnesota, it does not win you instant trust. And so it's just a part of why we need to have a meeting like this to talk about what the issues are for them. Thank you.
And so Gary has been our board president for the last couple of years, and he helped run our anti-racism team in the early 2000s as we have continued to diversify the MICA board of directors. Again, for those of you that don't know MICA, MICA is the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. We work to ensure that everyone, without exception, has a safe, decent, accessible, and affordable home. We do this by being a welcoming community where we love and treat others the way that we want to be treated. And people who have experienced homelessness or the housing crisis and diverse communities are represented as decision makers on our board and staff so that the solutions that we are promoting and we propose meet the needs of the people that are being impacted. Over half of our board have experienced homelessness, some of our board members back here, as well as 70% of our board are representative of diverse communities that have been impacted by the housing crisis. Our members are community and faith-based organizations working to address the immediate needs of people who are experiencing homelessness. So we have folks throughout the metro area that are doing shelter, transitional housing, clothing shelves, food shelves that are part of the count today and tonight. And then we also work together to make the systemic changes so that we are not having this growing number of homelessness, housing crisis, disparities, and discrimination. So some of the information that's in your packet is some work that we did in the 2013-2014 when the African-American Leadership Forum came to us and said, We have this incredible disparity in homeownership between Caucasian and our diverse populations within the community. And in 2012, 2013, 2014, we worked with 30 different culturally diverse groups, many that are represented here, as well as in some of the paperwork that you have before you, to begin to address the disparity. We were the worst in the country. We had the greatest disparity between Caucasian homeownership and our diverse communities. During that time, we also worked with then-Commissioner Tingerthal to create the Enhanced Home Ownership Initiative Program, which is basically to target monies that we've appropriated at the state level to help in providing dollars to culturally diverse communities to train people within their own communities to become homeowners. Just like many of us in this room, you know, if we were trained by somebody from a different culture on how to become a homeowner, that may be more difficult for us to understand. That's true for other cultures too. So we wanted to make sure that we are providing those opportunities. So we've pretty much varied from being like the third to the fifth worst. Sometimes we go back to being the worst over the last few years, but we have made significant progress in this area. And it's because we brought together people that have experienced homelessness, the housing crisis, and disparity in home ownership in actually moving that. We did pass the home law on the National Day of Prayer, which was signed into law by then Governor Dayton, and we greatly appreciate that. So oftentimes as faith community, we hear that the poor will always be with you. And that's quoted quite often as far as a part of scripture. But if you look in Deuteronomy 15 or if you look in Mark 14, it goes on to say, and whenever you will, you can do good for them. So in conclusion, we believe that if we listen to people impacted and design and implement housing opportunities to meet their needs, we have a much higher success rate in models and programs and housing opportunities that will work for folks. So we're going to show you one more short video of some of our board members that have experienced homelessness or the housing crisis as they tell you how come it's so important that we listen to folks, that they are decision makers, and that we actually are creating the opportunities that will be the best for their situation and for their family. And you'll see some of their smiling faces up here in the first couple rows too.
Data mining to find out when
one of the keys to justice is to ensure that people that have experienced homelessness or are at risk of homelessness or a housing crisis are major decision makers at every table.
I'm Gary Kwong, and I'm the board president of MICA. I've been on the board of Hmong American Partnership for 6 years and Hmong National Development for 5 years, and I've worked with the youth programs at United Cambodian Association. A big problem is that the Southeast Asians, because they're clan-oriented, they will bring other people into their families and they take care of their own. And you'll have three generations living in a house and they'll have multiple cars because, of course, everybody has to work. And you're trying to explain to people that they need a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment, but a house is cheaper. And that's a big part of housing is it has to work for everybody in that family. And you have a large family and not a lot of education.
I am Ahmad Hassan from the Somali community. I've been joining the MICA to get our voice heard. Normally, we can say average Somali-sized family is about 5 kids and the mother and father. But mostly there are more than that number. And the apartment houses or the apartments units available normally are 2 bedrooms, 3 bedrooms, and cannot accommodate that number. And Somalis do not, maybe in the other communities, they do not live together in different gender in one bedroom. And so that it brings up the to break the family in into apartment houses or more even that they can live even far away down the hall or maybe 2 floors or down or up one family.
My name is Janelle and I helped start Freedom of the Streets. Freedom of the Streets is a group where we tell the real truth about homelessness, about addiction, about prostitution, and about things that's behind the scene of homelessness.
Mission from Freedom from the Streets. This is a group that started in May of 2019. Our mission is to open opportunities for people who are experiencing homelessness, along with families that are without resources, helping each other to find resources and solutions.
You know, it's been doctors that's been homeless, it's been lawyers that's been homeless, it's been many other people that's been homeless that had a good job, and all they need is something to get back on their feet.
First, I'd like to give all thanks, praise, and honor to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Without him, I wouldn't be able to sit here before you today. I've met some of the most resourceful, intelligent people that been in this situation that I've ever met. They're just without a roof over their head. I think it's very vital for people in a homeless situation to be at the decision-making table. Instead of having someone sit on the outside guessing what you need.
We want to see people bring their ideas and their feelings and what's hard for them, what's the struggle for them. So having those people at the table is educational to those people that sits on the table.
When you sit at a table and you don't have those people with the experience there, you're just guessing on what could help them. And then while they're at the table, they could tell you if it will work or if it won't work. You can't make a decision for no one if you have not experienced that issue.
We are honored and blessed to have you as a part of MICA. Help us to support people that are experiencing homelessness and in the housing crisis to join us in our work together to make sure that everyone, without exception, has a safe, decent, accessible, and affordable home. Thank you for your support.
So our first speaker will be Ahmed Hassan of Mother's Tutoring Academy, which serves Somali.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Ahmed Hassan. I'm here today to raise pressing concerns regarding housing from the Somali community. Minnesota stands proud in its history of accepting and accommodating its diverse citizens in all facets. However, that's not the reality experienced by its Somali constituents. Due to my work in the community as one of the founders and current.
I'm going to just ask you to get a little closer to the microphone so you're speaking right into the, that you're speaking right into the microphone. Right.
Shall I start over?
No, it'll be just fine.
All right. Due to
and
my
by
work.
By the way, members, there are two handouts. You're speaking, among other things, to the Mother's Tutoring Academy. There are two handouts in your packet.
Yes. Due to my work in the community as one of the founders of and current executive of the Mother's Tutors Academy, we play an integral role in the lives of the Somali children and the Somali community by extension. We focus on bridging an education gap in the Twin Cities area by giving community children and youth tools to excel educationally, socially, and interpersonally. Through our mission and actions, we are involved in engaging not only the children, but also parents and the community at large as well. In our three after-school centers now in operation, we meet Somali parents who often express how redlining, gentrification, and culture affected their most basic rights, like housing. Presently, it is estimated that over 130,000 Somalis live in Minnesota, primarily in rented homes. However, in recent years, the amount of rent is the same or even higher than reasonable mortgage rate. Why the Somali community are not homeowners? While there are many factors that play part, some of the obvious explanations are, first, housing discrimination, institutional injustice like the exclusive exclusivity of mortgage loans, such as not having a chance to qualify for safe mortgage, but for high interest loans, subprime, predatory lending, and scams. Second, lack of understanding and information about home buying process, especially for many families whom English is a second language like the Somali community, and not knowing about down payment program assistance. Third, inadequate credit, lack of insufficient income and wealth, or savings to meet down payment requirements and pay closing costs. Somalis are very new into the country and in Minnesota as well. So therefore, would Somalis community families lack parents and grandparents who own homes of their own and boost financial capability to help their children and grandchildren with credit and down payments? On the top of these concerns is the family size of the community. Somali households tend to be bigger than average 2.5 children per American household. An average family size is about 6-5 persons. So we find it challenging to find a place that is suitable for the family at reasonable price to buy or to rent, which can fit the family. Unlike some cultural communities that tolerate, it is also the cultural norm of the community that and I dispersed further enforced by the religion that boys and girls of certain age, from 3 to 5 or and older, are to sleep separated from each other, which the lack of space does not allow for. Not to mention the racial home ownership gap that affects not only minorities, but especially the Somali community. Our status as a refugee and immigrant, black and Muslim population, create concerns in communities of predominantly white homeowners, which solidifies exclusionary zoning discrimination and not in my backyard policies. So we suggest, we think that there are solutions, and we have some suggestions. It is necessary to structure some forms of subsidies and other public interventions intended to expand access to home ownership with the intention towards fostering greater socioeconomic, racial, and ethnic integration. First, to devise a target purchase assistance program that address wealth barriers to home ownership. For instance, to provide home subsidies and loan assurance mechanisms. As being said, many families now pay rent amounts which are a lot higher than the average mortgage payments. Many families pay right now rent amounts which are a lot higher than the average mortgage payments. Second, to address the lack of understanding about home buying process that presents significant barrier to many minority families, to make available housing counseling tools to prospective for prospective home buyers. Third, to provide subsidies aimed to address at one or maybe all of the three following targets. First, lowering monthly payments, lowering the initial purchase price, providing down payment assistance. We as citizens have a normal duty not to repeat the mistakes of history and provide access to home ownership and therefore generational wealth. It is no secret that restrictions from housing greatly affected the wealth that African Americans could collect communally. I cannot help but see the same disparity emerging with the recent Somali refugees and immigrants here in the state. I urge to get ahead of the growing problem and start creating solutions to these community challenges. We can start by holding town halls, community meetings with Somali constituents, educating on what home ownership means and the benefit and wealth it might bring about. It's important to educate the methods to gain home and to protect individuals from predatory loans, scams, and to devise methods to facilitate home ownership, like providing loan assurance of some form and subsidies. As I said earlier, Minnesota stands proud in its history of accepting and accommodating its diverse citizens. Now it is the time for Minnesota to continue that tradition. Thank you.
Thank you. This is helpful. You've laid out challenges, but you've also provided suggestions and recommendations, and we appreciate that very much. And who are we inviting up next?
Madam Chair, I think Owen wanted to see if there were questions for each speaker as we went along, if that's what you want to do, or however you want to
watch,
do it.
We'll watch for
okay,
hands.
Thank
Members, you.
You
can, yeah, anytime you can just raise your hand, and we'll acknowledge that.
Else you won't see me.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Susan Pa, and I am here today representing HAP, Hmong American Partnership. I'm the director of our Economic and Community Development Impact Area. And I want to first just say thank you so much for allowing us this opportunity to speak with you about our housing disparities. Although HAP serves the entire community, today I will be speaking specifically about the Hmong community. And we see housing disparities all across Minnesota and with all Minnesotans. The Hmong people are an ethnic minority group of Laos that arrived in the United States in the 1970s as refugees. The Twin Cities is the largest urban concentration of Hmong persons in the United States, almost 75,000 according to the U.S. Census in 2016. The Hmong community continues to face housing disparities in great numbers. Approximately 30% of Hmong Minnesotans live under the poverty rate and struggle with attaining stable and safe housing. The Hmong lost 54% of their wealth, largely due to the foreclosure crisis and the decreased value in homes. Homelessness and the risk of homelessness is very real in the Hmong community. This is often masked because of our culture. The Hmong people tend to live together when they become homeless. They live with family, and therefore creating overcrowding in homes. And so sometimes homelessness can be masked by overcrowding, and then the homelessness is not as much seen. But it really does exist. So data indicates that 64% of Hmong families live in overcrowded housing conditions compared to 6% of the overall U.S. population. That's huge, 64 compared to 6. So, you know, I was watching the video and one thing really caught me. There was a banner that read, "A home is a human right." And so my ask, and on behalf of all the people that HAP serves every day, is that all of you, that you continue to fight for and make safe, stable, and affordable housing a possibility for all Minnesotans. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, again, Sue Watlow Phillips, as the next speaker is coming down. So you mentioned the one-night count that we have, the point-in-time count with HUD. Folks that are doubled up are not counted in that point-in-time count. And so only folks that are literally on the streets or in shelter or in some of our transitional housing. So the folks that experience homelessness in the Hmong community are not counted in this count.
Yes, Representative.
To that point, I was just curious, do you have anything like an approximation of how much that would play against the numbers that we have been, for the last few years, I've somewhat been aware of the numbers that exist in my community as well as the state at large. But clearly what you just said is sort of like a hidden factor that if, unless we actually say it out loud and or qualify our point-in-time number and say that is not counting the 100,000 people that we expect are actually living in more crowded conditions, or shared living would probably be a word set that would make sense to the non-impacted communities.
Madam Chair, Representative, so Micah and myself from the National Coalition as Vice President, we've been calling the point-in-time count an archaic count for a long time in that it does such a limited count of the number of people experiencing homelessness. As we cut shelter beds, which HUD did as far as funding, then we said that the numbers went down, which, of course, the numbers have continued to grow. So currently we have about 15,000 people in Minnesota that are in shelter, transitional types of facilities. That does not count all the people that are in permanent supportive housing that we fund at a very high level at, in the state level as well as on the federal level. We have in addition to that, we have 17,000 children that are in our school system each year in Minnesota that are experiencing homelessness. Now, the education definition of homelessness includes doubled up. The HUD definition does not. So we prefer using the education, the U.S. Department of Education's definition of homelessness, which really is a variety of makeshift types of situations that people are experiencing homelessness.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would, in some ways, by choosing one or the other, are you then obviating the impact of the numbers on somebody who's watching or somebody who's caring like us? We will at some point be reduced to the point of saying, well, this is the number. Well, if that's not really the number, if the real number is some other definition of the number, then that spreads our understanding into a certain amount of guesswork.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, this is why I encourage always the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to say the point in time is the minimal number, and that there is much higher numbers when you add the children that are in the school system, because without a larger comprehensive number, you think that you're addressing the issue by providing enough shelter or getting people in, as the governor has put money in to get people out of off the streets for a period of time. But this is a massive issue that we have in this country where we have not focused on really addressing the housing needs of people in the country. Now, it's not that we don't know how to do it. And I'll just briefly say this, if I can follow up later, is that we will spend in this state 4 to 5 times as much money on those of us that are homeowners who were probably renters, one of those people at some point in our life, but are now homeowners through the mortgage interest deduction, property tax deduction, capital gains, first-time home buyer. We will spend $2 billion the next 2 years in mortgage revenue bonds out of Housing Finance Agency for first-time home buyers. We will not invest that much. And so, of course, we're talking about $500 million bonding from the Homes for All campaign for affordable housing. But we are not investing in that starting place for people to move after they leave the place that they grew up in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I am Farhia Khalif. I am here today presenting Voice of East African Woman, and I just given passing around the work we do. As you guys may aware of it, Minnesota is serves the largest immigrant, especially refugees, communities in the country, in the nation. we are, as a immigrant communities, minority communities, are you aware of it? Minnesota also are number four when it comes to disparity in the state, in the country. Maybe last year we were like number two, number three, we fight in the crown, which one is going to be number one or number two or number three, who are going to be the disparity. That's alarming and shocking to know that still, as of the year 2020, the African-American, the Africans, the immigrants are all already, are still struggling about issues that other communities, especially the white communities, are not dealing with. When it comes to housing disparity, it's a crisis, it's alarming. The homelessness that's happening in the state of Minnesota, also it's alarming, and an epidemic, that's what I call it. We need to do something about that. As a legislator, you guys been elected, we voted for you, we put you in the seats, we ask you for you to fight for the voices for people who put you as the seats, which I mean is we as a community members hoping that you guys really take this serious of this homelessness that's happening in the state of Minnesota. You have the opportunity today, because it's not promised tomorrow, to do something about it. I don't want to just talk about the refugees and immigrants, but that's what we're here today. But we all humans who are the streets, this cold, this weather that's happening. Voice of East African Woman is one of the organizations that are on the ground every day fighting strongly, hardly to help homelessness, to make sure that they have a place to call home for a few nights. Give them a space that they can sleep at night. We'll give them a warm bed or food, or give them a place to get a shower. Voice of East African Woman provides emergency shelter here in St. Paul, Minnesota. We've been providing emergency shelter, especially culturally appropriate Muslim women, immigrant refugees who lives around here in the Metro Twin Cities. Our shelter doesn't discriminate regarding of your culture, your religion, your sex. Anybody who walks in our door, first come, first serve. We serve them based on the needs. If we can provide them overnight stay, if we don't have a place to stay, if somebody knock on our door, they can walk in, we provide them a place to stay until we provide them referral to other shelters that around the state of Minnesota, whatever that they can. We're asking for your support, and I'm also here to acknowledge and thank MICA, Metropolitan Interfaith Coalition for Affordable Housing, as I am also a member of MICA. I'm also a member of St. Paul NAACP, where we are fighting strongly, not only the homelessness, but many things that we're facing about the issues that minority communities, especially the African-American community, that's dealing with the homelessness. Madam Chair, you have the opportunity today. Members, you also have the opportunity today. We come here before you today, all of us took our time to let you know this is serious. When I see a mother who walks in the shelter who have five babies, right now a baby just got born in the shelter. We are helping her to provide her opportunity for give her a job so she can afford affordable housing. I have a mother with five babies. She can't afford. She just started working. Guess what? Every day when we find a place, it starts at $1,500 a month. And the jobs that she just provided that she probably will start next few days, she's not going to get paid more than $12 an hour. Even though that will help her, because if you look at the applications when you're looking for an apartment today, you have to make three times of your income to be qualified to rent for apartments. So the affordable housing is one thing, but the other thing that Voice of East African Woman advocates for housing are trying to do is within ourselves needs to be trained, but we don't have the opportunity that the funding to do that. And I'm hoping Minnesota, MHFA, Minnesota Housing Agency to look at that, help organizations, not only for Voice of East African Woman, but many organizations who are culturally appropriate, the African-American, the immigrant communities, the refugee communities. I can talk about, like my brother here, Gary, said earlier, we're not only here as the immigrant refugee, we're just like you guys. We want our families and these communities to get better. When we see Janelle earlier, you guys watched the video, when she said Sometimes we're not the only one who go in the streets and becoming homeless. But guess what? The lawyer sometime, or the doctor sometime, or one of you can lose your jobs. And then a few days, you might not know what to do. You might go have to file up to get some assistance. So for me here today, I'm asking for your support for Voice of East African Woman and organizations such as Voice of East African Woman to consider this year. I know it's a bonding year. I know Homes for All are fighting really hard for $500 million. But if you think about it, 40 million out of that $500 million shall go to the African-American, the immigrant community, refugee community organizations. $40 million. Is that a lot? Yes, just saying the word 40 million is a lot. But I'm hoping today to getting your support, thinking about as you continue with the fight for homelessness and affordable housing and home ownership. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Several speakers, by the way, have mentioned Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I should let you know that they're represented in the room today, and I see him taking notes regularly, so he is paying attention to the requests and advice that you provided. Thank you very much.
Thank you, madam.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for taking the time to hear me today. My name is Craig Hand, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Korean Organization of Minnesota. At this time, there are about 20,000 Korean people living in Minnesota. Most Korean people are political refugees who resettled in America over the past 10 years after living in Thailand refugee camps. There is also some secondary migration from other states, as many Koreans have found Minnesota welcoming and supportive. In my current role, I'm supporting refugees from Burma with housing and social service support. Today, I will talk about some of the housing problems our Korean community in experience. The Korean people are experiencing many of the same difficulties other refugee population have had, except to transportation, language barrier, and finding well-paid jobs. Nearly 80% of the clients who come to KUM make less than 140% of the federal poverty level. One big problem that our Korean people are having is finding houses within a space. Korean families are a multi-generation, averages between 4 to 7 people, keeping Korean families together is culturally very important. Only 40% of the clients we serve own a home, and only 8% receives subsidized housing support. This means most in our community are subsidized renters, as regulations often do not allow more than 2 people per bedroom, and because most apartments only have 1 or 2 bedrooms, make it difficult or impossible to find affordable housing, especially in the Twin Cities where most Koreans live. To keep family together, Koreans must look to renting houses. Renting a house is expensive. At this time, the Korean community has a strong need for more affordable public housing options. In October 1, 2018, Sepol Public Housing Agency stopped accepting applications for any bedroom size because there were too many applicants on the waiting list. Also, the waiting time for getting into public housing is 5 years. A recommendation I ask you to think about is create a policy that expands subsidized housing options so that the waiting time is reduced closer to 1 to 3 years. This would be very helpful for our Korean community. Thank you for honoring the Korean community by inviting me to present today. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And members, there is also a handout in our packet from the Korean organization also with some of these statistics. See somebody else coming forward?
So I had invited Sunny Chantra Wong to come, but he had to take his mother to the emergency room last night, so he didn't make it. And he represents the Lao community in Minneapolis. Now, there are only two Southeast Asian organizations in Minnesota that are approved by HUD for housing counseling, and that's Hmong American Partnership and Lao Assistance. And one of the things we wanted to specify is one of the ways to deal with this is to have money from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency go to those agencies in order to have their own housing counseling, because it's important to have somebody speak about housing counseling who understands the culture. And if you just hire somebody to do that, to work with those, it's not the same thing, because it takes time for you to be trusted and that you understand enough of the culture so you can explain it in a culturally appropriate manner and in terms they understand. Because I don't know how many of you have looked at the landlords' and tenants' rights and responsibilities that the Attorney General prints out, but it's not easy for you to understand if you've had no education or grade school education at the best. And if you graduate high school, it doesn't mean you understand it. And so then to say, oh, just go to the website, that's not going to do it, because they need to have the understanding of what you're talking about and the level of understanding of the other person. So our next speaker will be, Gary, could I just add to that?
Sure. Okay. So Sue Watlow Phillips again from MICA. So some of the information that's in your packet talks about the HECAT funded applicants and also about the enhanced home ownership. So with the HECAT dollars, which are dollars through Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and that stands for the Home Ownership Capacity Education and Counseling Program, basically 12% of that goes to diverse populations. The rest goes primarily to Caucasian-run organizations, although some of them also serve diverse population. The Enhanced Home Ownership Initiative, and I'm just looking through this very quickly to give you this number, is $3 million for fiscal year 2020 to 2021, so the 2 years in the biennial plan for Housing Finance Agency. Those dollars over the past few years have gone to Build Wealth, to CLUES, which is for Hispanic community, Hmong American Partnership, Neighborhood Development Alliance, Project for Pride and Living, and Three Rivers Community Action Partnership. And so what Gary was talking about, for you to be eligible for those dollars, you have to be certified by HUD to be a housing counselor. For many of our diverse communities, they have great difficulty in getting certified because of the language barrier, because of the culture barrier. And for many of the folks that are talking with you today, they are the primary staff person. So if one of the folks is gone, I mean, they may have one other person or two other people in the office, but if one person's gone, they're doing everything within their organization, or they may be the only person working in their organization. So they take time off to do the training so that they can bring that to their own community is very, very costly. So we need to really look at ways that we expand the opportunities as we become more and more of a diverse metro area, as well as a more and more diverse state, so that we provide more opportunities to for folks to develop wealth in our diverse communities and to become homeowners.
Thank you. Who's up next? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Hi, my name is Wei Pham. I'm with the Vietnamese Social Services. And thank you, everyone, for this opportunity, because I think that we are addressing a very important issues for everyone. Just a little bit background on VSS. It stands for Vietnamese Social Services. Our agency founded in 1987 as a nonprofit mutual assistance organization. And in 2005, we recognized that there are refugees still coming, so we welcome the current. And our board and staff have trained the current, and now it become the current organization of Minnesota. So our agency helping family across the lifespan. Most clients come to VSS and consider it's kind of like a one-stop for everything. And so that they can learn and that they can become fully functioning member of American society. So the most important lesson that we have learned over the last few years is how we're going to address the issues of housing. And as you have heard from so far, housing is a concern. So what are the issues when it comes to affordable housing for refugee and immigrants? Everyone here knows that access to quality and decent housing improves the overall well-being of everyone, including improvement in both physical and mental health. However, not all of us, despite research evidence that immigrants and refugee groups face the greatest barrier to securing the affordable housing. They have no credit history. They face discrimination and exploitation. They don't understand the system. They cannot speak the language, let alone read and fill out forms. At the same time, agency whose mandate is to expand affordable housing to all often lacks the cultural and community connections to effectively serve and empower immigrants. So what are the opportunities for us? A community work can achieve so much more. In the community, especially in organization based like VSS, we believe that the best solutions are grounded by the voices and the choice of the community that build on trust. Trust that is earned, first and above all, between our staff and our community members. Trust that is also built with our funding and implementation partners. So on the issues of affordable housing for immigrants, we endorse solutions that are suggested by community leaders across immigrant groups, cited by research completed by the Minnesota Housing Partnership, Minnesota Budget Project, and the University of Minnesota. With limited time, I want to call one of those solutions that we believe cuts across the issues. We call for more allocation of resources that prioritize culturally appropriate community engagement. The goal here is to promote and provide more educational workshops for immigrants' family with the type of communication that speak to and with them. This means grassroots effort in language and way that eliminate confusions with verbal and face-to-face dialogue and, of course, in-person gatherings. We call on housing agency to partner with cultural organizations because we have the legs and the arms that reach directly into the immigrant groups so that together we can make difference in achieving our missions. The depth of relationships is our greatest value in the equation for effective social services. And thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Was this distributed separately? Does yes. Everybody have this? Members, there's one, the last person listed is not going to be testifying. They have given written testimony, and that is Children's Hope International. And there, too, are priorities given and then arguments about potential cost savings around some of the, they do tie into some of the testimony you're hearing from others. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you for giving this opportunity. My name is Jamal. I represent Oromo Community of Minnesota. I read the summary of our organization, I just wanted to say about Oromo. Oromo is from Ethiopia, East African country. It is the largest ethnic group live in that country for a long time. And the majority of that country is Oromo. It constitutes about 40% of the land and the population. And the Oromo, with this large number, didn't get the appropriate or fair share of power. And when they raised that share of power, and they prosecuted and started killing by the regime, that is why the Oromo immigrated to United States as a refugee and as a migrant in large number, starting 1980. Having said that, I will explain about Oromo community of Minnesota. Then I will come to the housing problem of our population. The Oromo community, in short OCM, formally established as a community organization in 1985 and became 501(c) nonprofit organization in 2000. It was created to assist the growing number of Oromo immigrants and refugees from Ethiopia to settle successfully in Minnesota and in the Twin Cities in particular. We are the largest Oromo public outside of Oromia, with estimated 40,000 Oromo in the state of Minnesota. Although we serve all immigrants from any walk of life, one of the distinct competencies of OCM is that it is solidly rooted within the Oromo community and serving its clients with the multi-languages. This strong grassroots support has been successful as we purchased a community center building in St. Paul in 2008. We have achieved this by mobilizing community resources. Following several fundraising events, the OCM was able to end the mortgage on its building on August 31, 2010, making it the first African immigrant community to own community building in the state of Minnesota. We must continue our growth and give our community bigger capacity and ability. Governance. OCM is governed by 9 board of directors. The General Assembly elects the board of directors. They draft and translate OCM bylaws and oversees all management activities. The member of the community are those who maintain paying $5 membership fee a month and eligible to elect the boards of directors every 2 years. Service. The OCM service over 40,000 Oromo American in the Twin Cities. We are one-stop resource centers. The OCM provides multi-social service for the community. Our social services include, but not limited to, helping people in finding affordable housing, health insurance application, school navigation, interpretation, transportation, and the immigration services. Significant number of OCM members are either unemployed or underpaid due to several reasons. As a result, large number of OCM members are participated in SNAP benefits and lives in subsidized public housing program. According to randomly taken data, the average annual income for family 3 to 5 members ranges from $15,000 to $27,000. It is obvious that the need for housing in our community is very high due to their income and the family size. Language barriers and the cultural difference are some factors of difficulty. These challenges are high among newly arrived immigrants. Background checks, number of family size, and the proximity of the housing availability to shopping and the resource area are some of the challenges. Also, those who are interested in purchasing housing cannot easily overcome the hurdle. Down payment and the closing cost is not something easily covered. On the other hand, most of our community members are Muslim. Due to religious obligation, they are hesitant to lend from bank because paying interest is strictly forbidden according to Muslim doctrine. Thus, the OCM needs to utilize the available opportunity and the strong support from HUD to overcome the challenges. Finally, I'm asking the state to support in getting funds for certified housing counselor training and the employment budget for housing program process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And members, there was also a handout in our packets for this particular testimony. And we have one more.
Because we brought up the issue of the housing counseling, and I'd like to have Susan talk about that from Hmong American point of view, because it's not obvious what it costs and how you're going to do that. And so she'll just talk a little bit about that.
Welcome again. Please identify yourself for the record.
Susan Paugh, Hmong American Partnership. So as of August 2020, all agencies that do housing counseling will need to be certified. That means that their agency will have to have at least one staff go through the training, pass an exam, and be certified. And that they would, on a consistent basis, have to maintain a certification in order to be a HUD agency that can do housing counseling. And so that's a great step, but the problems is that now we don't have the funding and the help that agencies or nonprofits need in order to get HUD certified. So we want to make sure that there are resources available to nonprofits that currently do housing counseling for our people in our community to be able to access the training that's necessary to be able to pass the exam and to get certified, and also to understand what that certification process is. I can just tell you I've read many packets about the certification process. At times it looks really simple, and at times it looks like, wow, this is super complicated. So that is going to be a barrier in 2020 for nonprofits to be able to serve our community. And I just wanted to bring that up and let you know that when certain policies like this come to pass and certifications are required, there should always be a component to building capacity to be able to have nonprofits continue the work that they do. Because for sure, we don't want nonprofits that are already doing great work to not no longer be able to do that work because they're not certified.
Thank you. Do we have one more testifier from the community, or are the two of you concluding?
Well, Madam Chair, Sue Watlow Phillips, if I could just add a few more data points just to help people understand. So as you've heard today, many of our communities need more than like one or two bedrooms, which is typically what we create in the housing that we develop with our bonding dollars or and our other housing dollars, although we do have a number of developers that are starting to do 3 and 4 bedrooms. So it's really important that we have our folks that are accessing the dollars listen to the community about what the needs are, and not just to how do you make money off of creating this affordable housing. The second thing is to understand how much it really costs. So for many of us, so I grew up in the 50s and 60s, I paid $100, $125 for my first deficiency by the University of Minnesota when I was training for the Olympics and in sports there. $200 for a 4-bedroom home, okay? For you to afford a 2-bedroom home now in the metro area, you need to be making $22 plus per hour, working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. In greater Minnesota, it hovers between $18, $19, and even $22 if you're in one of the larger communities. So, and a lot of the starting home ownership is starting more at $350,000. So we need to look at a wide variety of housing opportunities for folks so that shelter or living on the streets or living doubled up is not the only opportunity. You know, we need to understand that the income and the housing doesn't work all the time for most people that are starting entry jobs as they come out of high school or as they come out of college. We also have a lot of folks that are carrying a lot of school debt, healthcare debt, other things like that that get in the way of them qualifying for home ownership. So as we continue to move with you through this session, we hope to continue to provide, you know, different ways that you can take a look at how we're utilizing our dollars, not only on the appropriation side and the bonding side, which you folks have a lot of input in, but also on the tax expenditure side, which you also vote on. We spend an incredible amount of money on the tax expenditure side for those of us as homeowners, okay? And we also do the, as I mentioned, $2 billion over the next 2 years in mortgage revenue bonds for first-time homebuyers. We need to make sure that we're creating more equity in how we're using our housing resources in all the different fundings.
What I'm struck by is that there are families who have figured out that if three families cooperate, it is less expensive for those three families to share a home than it is apartments. And so they've done some problem solving there to keep themselves in a building and not on the street. The consequence of that, however, is that that's an invisible group. They're burdened with not sufficient individual space, but it's invisible to us, and as you pointed out, not counted.
And Madam Chair, just to add on, I think a couple other options in addition to people doing that type of doubling up until the early 2000s, we funded the home share program, where we had individuals and families that were at risk live with other families or individuals and share a home together. That was defunded, although still an eligible activity under our state housing trust fund, to match up people so that they can share a home because, you know, folks such as myself, you know, I own a four-bedroom Rambler. I bought the house I grew up in Fridley, so I've been there for 66 years, is that, you know, I have three bedrooms that are sitting that aren't used all the time, and I share that with other people. And there are ways that we can continue to create opportunities to do that, as well as what's called the ADU or the accessory dwelling unit, so the old mother-in-law apartment, is making those types of opportunities available. So we're being smarter about how we're using housing. And certainly the work that we've done with MICA and with the Envision, which with doing tiny homes, is something that I think that we need to continue to look at. We did a hearing in the Senate on tiny homes, both as home ownership and as rental. Envision, which many of our board members are involved with, we've passed legislation in Minneapolis now that we can put that in any zoning, residential zoning in Minneapolis. So there's many different ways that we can think about housing opportunities for folks, and so I think we need to start thinking out of the box again.
Representative Herr has a question.
Madam Chair, not as much a question, but just a quick comment that I really appreciate the presentations today. I was just having conversation with someone I was with last night about my family and how the issues we're experiencing today around housing, around families and how they live, is no different than it was 40 years ago when my family came, and yet we haven't learned from those, from the immigrants that have come before, to create housing that fits the needs of our diverse communities coming to this country. I remember my family, our port city was Chicago, and we lived in low-income housing for just a short time, but my father's ability to get a living wage working for Snap-on Tools was what allowed my family to buy a home the first year after coming to America. And I didn't realize the importance of having that home in the way that it has shaped our lives and the equity that my family was able to build in order for us to end up with six kids in our family, five bachelor's, four master's, and one doctorate. And the brother who did not have his degree actually served the military and became a computer engineer. So in my family, we have four engineers and two people in finance. I did not realize that it was having that stable home and living multi-generational. There's 14 people living at our house at one time. My grandmother, my father's siblings. My grandfather unfortunately died as we were escaping to the United States. He was shot by the Viet Cong in the jungles while we were leaving. And so it left my grandmother who could not take care of herself. So we lived in a multi-generational family. It was the ability to have housing that led us to overcoming any achievement gap or issues around opportunity gaps. It was the ability then for us to go on to college. It was the ability for us to have security, housing security, which created an ability for us to use other resources to create food security, to create other environments in which allowed our family to make it through each step of the way. And so I appreciate the testimony today because I think oftentimes we think that immigrants who do make it, refugees who do make it, the way my family has, that we just worked harder than everybody else. That's not true. Everybody is working hard, and we were just put in circumstances that allowed us the opportunity to create an environment that allowed my family to thrive, and we were able to break the cycle of poverty in one generation. If we want to solve all the issues that we have now around poverty, around education disparities, housing is fundamental to that. So thank you all for the presentations today, and thank you, Madam Chair. It was just a comment I wanted to make around that, so thank you.
Very helpful, because, of course, she's just told the story of when all of the things that you've just talked about aren't working, when they work, it's a transformative opportunity for a family. So, I mean, the juxtaposition of these stories is very, very helpful.
And I'm Gary Kwong, and I'd like to add one last comment. Is one specific suggestion I have is that because when an agency gets a person who is certified, but if that person leaves, then the agency is no longer able to do that. So if you could somehow allocate funding so that two people could be trained, because otherwise if that one person leaves, which is, as she said, if you get more educated then somebody else hires you, then the agency loses their trained person. And the other thing is it's hard to ask for grants to get training and to have that person work for a year. If you initially get the trained person, doesn't mean there's money in their overhead to cover. As you know, most agencies get like 6% maybe, and you can't just spend it for whatever you want either necessarily. So it's important if you could also get training money to get operational money for that agency for a year. Because if that person works for a different agency or a state agency, it's not quite the same thing. As some of you may have encountered, that when you call or you go on the phone tree for an agency, you don't necessarily get a live person if you call in the evening because you're working at several jobs. You don't get a live person who says, oh, what language do you need? And if you don't have that, then what are you going to do? Because even if you're a high school graduate, right, doesn't mean that you understand all the stuff that you're going to be asked or that you feel safe providing that information to somebody you have no idea who they are. So that's why we're talking about having the agencies do the counseling for both rental and home ownership, because as you said, home equity is a very important feature to moving ahead. And we need the education and the jobs and the transportation. It's all tied to housing. Thank you.
Representative Salk, did I see your hand earlier?
No, I think you just, Madam Chair, I think you just saw the wheels of my brain formulating a question, but I do have one, and I may ask Brian to jump in with me because I think you've also got common professional experience in loan underwriting and or house buying and selling and those kinds of things. No?
No.
I thought you.
Law enforcement.
Oh, law enforcement. I thought you had some housing. Anyway, the point is that this business of housing advisors or a process by which you become knowledgeable of what doorways you're going to try to walk through, that is something that right now all of us have that problem. Most of us in the privileged community have it happen to us at a very young age where we are supported by oftentimes family, parents who are already owners. And so when the bank says to you, you're required to take this class, my sons and daughters said nothing about that because they knew that, oh, Dad will take care of that. And sir, they came home, they said, what's this business? I understood the whole system already, and I mapped it out for them. There is a gigantic difference, and that's this issue of cultural aware counselors. What you were just making this point, it is huge because, yes, there are not enough counselors. In Rochester right now, there was, to my knowledge, there was only one. She has retired recently, and I don't know what they've done to backfill it. One person who everybody that's getting a federally subsidized loan, doesn't matter where you, what your ethnicity or anything is, you have to take that class or you're not going to get funded. And most of us have no knowledge of that because, like me, we're way past that in our lives. And so until you brought it up, I started to realize how significant that little doorway is. It's significant to all of us, mm-hmm. and we are not providing that service in a culturally aware way in that those people understand a lot of different languages. Somehow they slip past that law of that they have to require, they have to provide their service in a way that can be understood by the people applying. So we have this out there. And again, I'm starting to get, I don't know, I've been on away from here long enough that I'm starting to get fires built. But this industry and this element, they are just describing to us little tweaks of some of the most insidious biases that we have in general home ownership. We just ignore it because our kids can go get through it. I'm saying our, the majority community, we can get through these things. So oftentimes they're not struggling. There are other people that also have to have the same struggle. If you've had any offenses in your life, so you've got other kinds of things like that, those are also impediments, gateways that stop somebody from moving through. I'm glad you stepped up there because this is, you're one of the people that built the fire. But I really think that this is something we should be aware of as we are sitting here with our trying to make our big funded ideas. We have to understand that there's sometimes these kinds of things going on in our communities that we can generate gigantic things. None of them are going to get there because they can't get through that doorway, the counseling doorway, the I don't understand doorway, because at the end of the day, that big thing that we've funded is a barrier because they have to go through the training to get to that thing. Sorry. I appreciate all you've been listening to that.
And as I've looked at both the speakers and the handouts that we have, that is the thing many people kept coming back to, that particular thing that he has just summarized. Yes. Well, welcome back.
Susan Pahap. I just wanted to add, as we're talking about lack of funding, that HAP as a nonprofit, we'll be celebrating 30 years this year. And we've been doing home ownership and housing counseling for a long time. But this past year, as we talked about our programs with our board and as a leadership, we actually thought about cutting out or stopped. We talked about stopping our program with housing. And it's not because we don't see the need out there. We really do. And it's not because we don't have clients that need our service, because we serve hundreds of clients. But because of the funding that we receive, you know, nonprofits struggle all the time with how do we serve the people and still be able to have a building and operate. And I will let you know that out of all the programs that we operate out of HAP, our housing program is the least funded program. It doesn't have the funding. And we just couldn't support the staff anymore. We came to a crossroad where we said, should we continue this program, even though we know it's needed, and try and find donations outside of our grants and funding to try and supplement this work? Or do we finally come to a crossroad where we say, this just isn't a program we can support anymore? And we decided we can't stop the work, because as Representative Hur says, it really is a fundamental basis for all other successes and for families to thrive. But I want to appeal to you, because I want to appeal to you and let you know that there's so many nonprofits just like us who struggle every day between deciding whether to cut a program because of funding or to continue because there's still a need. And I will tell you, the housing is one that we continue to every single year have that talk. And I just want to see 2020 and ongoing forward for us to have some relief in that, say, we don't have to worry about the funding anymore. We just have to worry about the work in front of us. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions, any concluding comments that Micah has.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, I want to thank you so much for this opportunity to have a pre-hearing prior to the session for all of you attending. This was an incredible attendance, so thank you very much. I want to thank all the speakers and all the folks that came also. So home ownership is the way that we create wealth in our country, individual wealth. That's what we use to pay folks, our kids, to be able to go to school. That's how we start businesses. Those are ways that we do that. So we need the housing counselors there that are certified so that we can keep that in our community. But we also need folks within our culturally diverse communities that know the housing business on the rental side too, and to develop the capacity of our developers that are creating affordable rental housing that are in our diverse communities, so that we're creating wealth in those communities. Aurora St. Anthony, Build Wealth, there's a number of groups, CLUES, other groups, Hmong American Partnership, that are doing that. But we need to continue to expand that so that we are creating opportunities for all of our communities to do well.
I just want to thank Micah not only for the organizing effort for this, but for your ongoing work. I took advantage of one of your tours this summer as you take us out in the community. And for all of the, do we have one other person who wants to come forward? Oh, okay. For all of the people who took part of today and told your story, and we've got good information printed that we can take with us as well.
I had a question.
Is there a gentleman that can you come to the testifying table?
And I would just put in the people who are here are willing to talk to you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Grandma Hassan. I'm from Oromo community as well, and of course from Ethiopia community, I could say. I have a question. My question is, you all understand home is a basic need, yet in Minnesota we have this disparity. How, as a community, leaders can work with you guys to address this problem? I haven't seen anything mentioned about that. That's why I just raised my hand. We are in need of housing in Minnesota today as we speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Nothing else in life goes well if you don't have a safe place to sleep at night. It begins there. I think in partial answer, today's hearing is sort of a beginning step for the question you pose. We have a lot of work to do. The good news is there are amazing nonprofits already functioning. Just the one that I think I've referenced with you, Beacon, which is another faith-based group organizing 100 faith communities, they have identified this lack of 3- and 4-bedroom apartments. It's the next, I think they're doing one in Plymouth right now, but they have others identified. So I think there's much work still to do, but I'm grateful for all of the organizations that are.
And Madam Chair, just to respond to that, Sue Watlow Phillips again. So, and Beacon does great work. Their housing is primarily supportive housing. We need housing that we have a large portion of our population that just needs housing and not necessarily the support services. So in supportive housing, we're spending $250,000 or more per unit. Plus then we need to subsidize it $20,000 to $40,000 per unit per year. So it is a very expensive way for us to create housing opportunities, but it is a necessary part of our housing continuum. So as you look at the housing infrastructure bond that will come before you, we will also have provisions in there, a new provision that will create housing at 50% of median and below 30%, with targeted at 30% of median, so people in the metro area at 30,000 and less, that does not require support services. And we really encourage you to look at that as an additional option.
Well, I think we've reached the end of our time here. So thank you again for all of you for taking part of it. We've just started the conversation. Meeting is adjourned.